Anger stirred in Grant's eyes, and he clenched his fists. Shizuka noticed and laid a hand on his arm.
Let's not argue the point. Let's hear him out.
Sindri looked at her blankly.
Entropy describes a process by which the universe is slowly running down, so slowly that it can only be measured in terms of eons. Every particle of matter is losing energy, and this energy, in the form of heat and light, gradually accumulates throughout the universe. The rate at which bodies lose their energy is the entropic gradient. It appears that this process is also part of the process that we call the passage of time, or our perception of its passage. The entropic gradient is steady, incessant, and inexorable.
Kane thought about asking for a clarification about the difference between a perception of time passage and the passage itself, but decided to let the little man continue. This was Sindri's show, and he liked nothing better than to strut in the spotlight. Such dedication to being the center of attention would eventually make him careless.
The physical constituents of the universe, oh, let us say in the year from which Oakshott was trawled, 1899, were quite different than those constituents at any other time. That's a fundamental bit of physics, both quantum and relativistic.
In other words, you can't step into the same river twice.
Exactly, Miss Baptiste. The implications of that old bromide are clear enough. It means there's a difference in entropic measurements in regard to capacity for energy. And the difference between the universal constituents in 1899 and 2199 add up to a substantial amount. Now we reach the truly fun part. What entropy means to me.
Whatever it means, it can't mean anything good. At least not anything good for the rest of us.
Sindri's lips stretched in a grin, displaying his perfect teeth.
You could be so wrong, Mr. Grant, that you would cease to be even pathetic. If the entropic gradient of any piece of matter can be reversed, either organic or inorganic, if it can be restored to the status of matter of, say, 300 years ago, we don't just have a temporal dilator.
He wheeled toward Bridget, stabbing a finger at her.
Quickly, Miss Bridget, what would we have?
She frowned and unconsciously nibbled at her underlip. Kane watched her face and was surprised by the expression that suddenly crossed it. It wasn't only comprehension, it was horror.
Immortality. You would have, for all intents and purposes, a machine to make anything or anyone immortal.
Sindri nodded in smug triumph.
Precisely, Miss Bridget. A god machine.
Sindri's pronouncement brought all conversation to a complete halt. A number of things popped into Kane's mind to say, but he knew Sindri wouldn't appreciate any of them. Shizuka broke the silence.
Why should we believe anything you say, particularly an insane boast like that? You're not only a madman, you're a liar.
Anger made a mask of the face of the dwarf. He turned as if to summon Oakshott. Ever so slightly, Kane shifted position, readying himself to kick the little man full in the face before he could verbalize an order. With a visible effort, Sindri regained control of his temper.
Immortality is the one dream that always haunted man, yet eluded him. He has hungered after immortality in the same way he hungered after great power.
He waved toward the forked pylon.
That is the source of both.
I won't dispute you on one score, but how do you know entropic reversal works on organic matter? The physical body is a chemical machine. It wears out. Corrosion eats away at cell structures, at the nervous system, at the marrow of the bones. Going back in time 1,000 years and then returning to this time period won't ensure you'll live for a millennium. There's no way you can prove your theory.
Sindri made a sly smile.
Actually, I have empirical evidence, but I need more. That's where you three enter the equation. I'd hoped you'd bring your little pet albino with you, since she has already been exposed to the Cronon radiation, but I can make do with the material I have here.
Kane, Grant, and Bridget gaped at him as Sindri pointed a finger at them, one by one.
You? I'll send to the Triassic Age. You to the Bronze, and you... you, Miss Bridget, I owe a bloodletting, and therefore a lesson in humility. Perhaps I'll send you to Caligula's Rome, or inject you into the fall of Troy. If you survive, you'll have some interesting tales to bring back.
With a whir and a click, Cain's Sin Eater sprang into his hand.
Perhaps I'll send you to hell, Sindri, and you won't have any interesting tales to bring back.
Grant flexed his wrist tendons, and his own autoblaster slapped into his waiting palm. Sindri regarded both weapons with inscrutable eyes.
I suppose now would be the best time to play my ace.
You'd better do something. I know I've run out of reasons to keep you alive.
Oakshot lumbered forward, aiming his wooden pistol at Grant.
Bang, bang. Behave yourself, Solar. Bang, bang.
Grant grimaced in annoyance, lifted the Sin Eater, and squeezed off a single shot. The cracking report was painfully loud. The round center-punched Oakshot in his exceptionally broad chest and slammed him backward. He dropped his toy gun, and his huge arms windmilled in a clumsy attempt to keep his balance. He fell heavily onto his back, his huge hands balled over his sternum, scarlet squirting between the fingers. Grant trained the pistol on Sindri.
What was that about an ace?
Seemingly not the slightest bit perturbed by the shooting of Oakshot or the gun inches from his forehead, Sindri held up two gloved fingers.
Two aces, actually. The first is the tried and true tactic of holding a hostage.
And who might that be?
Everyone in New Edo.
Shizuka's shoulders jerked in reaction. Bridget challenged the idea.
Explain.
Gladly. During the late 1990s, there was an epidemic of disappearing nuclear warheads from arsenals all over the world, in particular the small squeeze-yield ones.
Bridget frowned, sifting through her memory.
Yes, I remember reading about it. They called them backpack nukes. Evidently, they were stolen and sold to small nations without nuclear weapons capabilities, or to terrorist groups.
That was one theory, and I'm sure that happened to a few of them, but not all.
He widened his eyes in mock fear.
I wonder what happened to the others.
Bullshit! You're bluffing!
Sindri crooked challenging eyebrows at Grant.
Oh, really? If I can snatch a human being literally from the jaws of death, don't you think it would be easier to snatch up stationary objects from the past, like missiles in silos?
He paused to let his words sink in.
I confess, I managed to make only one functional, but it's more than sufficient to obliterate this island and New Edo. The warhead is fairly small, around 200 kilotons, but it's exceptionally dirty, a mixture of cobalt and iodine. If I detonate it, the yield effect is roughly 3 miles. Within 1 mile of the hypocenter of the explosion, this entire island would be vaporized instantly. Within 2.5 miles, 90% of the population of New Edo would be killed, and all the buildings leveled.
Shizuka's face paled, but she only compressed her lips, while Cain looked away casually.
How do you control it?
That will be my secret.
And the other ace you mentioned?
Sindri gestured toward the fallen Oakshot.
The empirical evidence of reverse entropic immortality. Oakshot, you may get up now.
He's not gonna get up, you little pissant.
A deep, gargling groan rose from the black-clad body. Cain felt his skin prickle and clammy sweat form on his face. The body of Oakshot stirred. His hands came up, the bloody fingers twitching fitfully. Grasping the railing, he pulled himself to a sitting position. Grant, Cain, Bridget, and Shizuka stared in incredulous horror as the giant reeled upright. His small eyes were glassy. Blood glistened wetly on his shirt front, and his face was screwed up in pain.
Hurts.
A coughing fit overcame him, and he bent at the waist, his body shaking violently. A jet of scarlet spewed from his lips, and a little metal cylinder clattered on the grillwork. Cain, his heart turning to ice, realized it was the flattened bullet Grant had fired into the giant's chest. Gasping for air, Oakshot straightened. He dragged a sleeve across his blood-flecked lips. Sindri waved reassuringly.
You'll be as right as the mail soon enough, Oakshot. That's a stout fellow.
Sindri smirked into the astonished faces of the four people standing around him.
I can only speculate on the extent of entropic reversal on organic matter. But as you have witnessed, Oakshot's cellular structure renews itself from moment to moment. It rejects all foreign bodies, from bacteria to bullets.
His hand trembling perceptibly, Grant raised his Sin-Eater and aimed at Oakshot's head, who merely blinked at him.
And what happens if I blow his brains out? Will that be reversed?
I really couldn't say. I was saving that experiment for one of you three. However, if you do that to Mr. Oakshot, I'll have no choice but to retaliate with a nuclear detonation. A bit of overkill, I can't deny, but you would leave me no option.
Very slowly, Grant lowered his arm.
Very good, Mr. Grant. Now, you and Mr. Kane will disarm.
Kane didn't move.
Why should we? We refused to do it earlier.
Then, you didn't have an inkling of the kind of power I control. Even if you're 90% certain I'm running a bluff about the warhead, surely you don't want to gamble the lives of New Edo.
I'm sure this has occurred to you at some point, but you'd die along with them.
I'm not afraid to die, Miss Bridget. Not in the least. That's one thing about me you should be certain of.
He gazed up at her unblinkingly.
Don't force me to prove it.
Sindri's voice had acquired a raspy undertone of conviction. Kane understood that somewhere inside of the man's diminutive frame was a soul that had lived with pain since the day he was born, and whose focus in life was to find a way to end it.
So much for your promise you meant us no harm.
I mean to keep my promise. I'm offering you immortality. How is that harming you? I may hurt you, but I won't permanently harm you. Not if you cooperate.
Grant cast a questioning glance toward Shizuka.
It's your home at stake here, so it's your call. Yes or no?
Shizuka hesitated and nodded in resignation.
Yes. We cannot take the chance.
Kane and Grant pushed their pistols back into their holsters and stripped them off. They pushed them into Sindri's arms. He inclined his head in a parody of a gracious nod.
Thank you, gentlemen. I always knew you could be reasonable, at least when you're forced to be.
He turned, marching back toward the control room.
Come with me now.
The four people slowly followed him along the catwalk. As they did so, Kane bent his head close to Bridget.
I'm betting you remember how to activate the dilator.
Her lips barely moved.
You'd win.
Kane said no more. He lengthened his stride to step in front of her. When they entered the control room, he positioned himself in such a way that Bridget was blocked from Sindri's view. As it was, the little man was pushing the still-dazed Oakshot ahead of him.
Step lively now.
As the giant obeyed, Bridget slid to one side, standing at the edge of the console. She ran her eyes over the buttons and toggle switches. Her fingers flew over them like a concert pianist's. The throbbing vibration of the generator suddenly climbed in scale and pitch, becoming almost painful. Sparks flashed through the facets of the prisms on the arms of the pylons. Sindri spun, arms full of pistols and holsters. His face twisted in shock.
What are you doing? The Cronon waveguide doesn't have a target!
Grant lunged forward in a diving tackle. He ducked under an arm Oakshot flung out and closed his hands around Sindri's throat, slamming him off his feet. As he grappled with the little man, the momentum of his leap carried him into Oakshot's legs and sent him staggering backward. Grant snatched up the little man, left hand cupping his chin, while his right forearm came across the windpipe and hauled back. Sindri uttered a small, aspirated gurgle.
Tell your lobotomized valet to back off, or you're dead in about 2 seconds.
Sindri clawed impotently at Grant's arm, then waved at Oakshot. The giant, in the process of lumbering forward, froze in mid-step. Shizuka glided forward and picked up the Sin-Eaters. Carefully, Grant got to his feet, holding Sindri in front of him. Kane was irresistibly reminded of a ventriloquist and dummy he had seen in an old pre-dark vid.
Tell him to back all the way off.
Sindri squirmed.
You idiot! You don't understand! You've got to cut the dilator's power!
Grant cinched his grip tighter, increasing the pressure on the dwarf's neck. Sindri yelped in pain.
Tell him.
Current crackled loudly between the forks of the pylon. From the curving arms hissed bolts of lightning, which whipped and snapped along the network of wires like serpents made of blue plasma. Sindri exhaled a pain-choked breath.
Oakshot, go to the corner and stay there until I say otherwise.
The giant hesitated.
Do as I say, damn you!
Ponderously, Oakshot followed Sindri's command, stepping to the far wall and jamming himself into the corner. Grant edged toward the door. His companions followed him, keeping their eyes on Oakshot. They entered a corridor, dimly lit by neon strips on the ceiling. They had traversed it before, and Bridget took the lead, since she remembered all of its twists and turns.
Wait, listen to me!
Sindri tried to speak several times, but Grant clapped a hand over his mouth. After a few minutes, they pushed their way through a glass and chrome door and entered a large lobby. The floor was thickly layered with concrete dust. The walls were black-speckled marble and showed ugly crisscrossing cracks. A litter of office furniture was half-covered by broken ceiling tiles. A big reception desk occupied the far wall, and it was nearly buried by plaster and metal electrical conduits. On the right side of the room, a hallway stretched away, lined on both sides with wooden doors. Past the desk lay the entrance door. Beyond it, they saw only a murky semi-darkness as of late afternoon on an extremely overcast day.
What's the plan?
How the hell do I know?
I'm open to suggestions. I'm sure as hell tired of carrying this slag-ass midget around.
There may still be landing boats at the beach, ones we used to get here from Nuedo.
One problem, Shizuka. Once the temporal dilator builds up a charge, it releases a microwave pulse. If we're not out of the effect radius, we'll be cooked.
Kane watched Sindri squeal wordlessly behind Grant's muffling hand, kicking his legs violently. His eyes shone with wild, frantic light.
Let him talk.
Grant removed his hand.
It's worse than the microwave pulse. I've got to cut the power. Let me do it, and you can go on your way.
Kane stared into Sindri's face, looking for any signs of duplicity. He gave it up after a moment as a pointless exercise.
What's worse than the pulse?
Sindri struggled in Grant's arms.
Put me down, and I'll tell you.
Kane nodded.
You'd better do it.
Scowling, Grant released the little man, allowing him to drop none too gently to the floor. He stumbled and would have fallen if Kane hadn't steadied him.
Explain, and make it fast.
Words tumbled out of Sindri's mouth.
Critical mass! Critical mass!
What?
Sindri squeezed his eyes shut, his body trembling.
There's a critical mass for certain elements, plutonium for instance, beyond which no increase in energy is possible without a release. It's the same with some subatomic particles.
Bridget's green eyes were bright with worry.
Like chronons?
Sindri bobbed his head.
And photons. Once critical mass is reached, it can only resolve itself by a venting of energy. There has to be an escape.
Shizuka looked apprehensive.
You mean an explosion?
Yes, possibly even a dimensional cross-rip. I wasn't lying about possessing an atomic warhead. The dilator is running wild without a target conformal. If its energy builds to critical mass, it'll touch off the bomb. A hole half a mile deep could be blasted through the bottom of the Pacific Ocean.
And you can keep that from happening?
Yes, if you let me go right now.
Kane and Grant looked toward Bridget in unison. She met their questioning gaze with one of angry frustration.
Don't look at me! I don't know enough about Operation Kronos to confirm or deny anything he's saying.
Kane hissed out an obscenity, looking at Grant.
We can't afford to take the chance.
I know. Damn him to hell.
Kane stepped aside and waved toward the door.
Go! We'll settle up with you later. Count on it.
Hey!
Without another word or a backward glance, Sindri immediately broke into a sprint, running as fast as he could, slamming open the door with a squeal of rusty hinges. Shizuka watched him go.
What should we do now?
Kane handed Grant his sin-eater and began strapping his own onto his forearm.
What we always do when we're in a situation like this.
Shizuka cocked her head at him quizzically.
What's that?
Bridget balanced herself on the balls of her feet and spoke a single word.
Run!
In their rush to get away from the Operation Kronos installation, the four of them simply ran, away, anywhere, beyond the effect radius of the microwave pulse. Grant slammed open the door and they plunged down a short, wide set of stairs and out into the complex of structures. Dusk shrouded them, yet the semi-darkness was a blessing. They were, after all, in enemy territory, in Sindri's playground, where the possibility of any threat couldn't be discounted. Kane glanced back at the building they had just left. It was the largest structure and showed little signs of wear. It was an almost perfectly square block, appearing to be hewn from a single monstrously huge chunk of stone. He had named it the Cube on their prior visit. Its dark facade had no windows, and when he looked at it, he again sensed a subliminal aura of evil radiating from the structure. All the looming buildings of the Operation Kronos base were made of blocks of a dark, stained stone that reflected no trace of light. Some of the smaller buildings had eroded so much they had fallen completely into ruin. Roofless arches reared from the ground, and a few storage buildings were scattered around the outer perimeter of the walls. They clambered over walls, concentrating more on what lay behind them than ahead. Kane, Shizuka, Bridget, and Grant ran across a broad courtyard filled with great chunks of concrete and blocks of basalt that had fallen from buildings. As the fleetest of foot, Kane had to hold himself back so as to not outdistance his companions, and he chafed at the delay. They reached a broad blacktop avenue that ran outward from the cube. The asphalt had a peculiar ripple pattern to it, and weeds sprouted from splits in the surface. Kane, Bridget, and Grant had seen the rippling effect before, out in the Hell Zones. It was a characteristic result of earthquakes triggered by nuclear bomb shockwaves. Lamp posts lined the road, most of them rusted through and leaning over. Secondary lanes stretched out in all directions like the spokes of a wheel. Legs pumping, lungs laboring, the four people sprinted through the empty streets, bordered by the empty husks of buildings. One of the structures had collapsed entirely, folded in on itself like a house of dominoes, with the fallen rear wall knocking down all the interior sections one by one. Once beyond the complex area, a bitter, acrid odor stung their nostrils and coated their tongues. Their pounding feet churned up ash and grit. They had entered the dead zone, a flat, sandy plain at least half a mile across, wherein the microwave pulses had rendered the soil sterile. What little grass grew was thin and brown, little more than stubble. Even in the fading light, they could see the circle of demarcation. On the far sides of the circle grew thick, lush grasses and ferns. Sprinkled across the barren and sere landscape were the brown skeletons of birds, their featherless wings outstretched as if they had dropped dead in mid-flight. Here and there were similar collections of bones, like those of rats and other animals. Light gleamed dully through the layer of ash, and when they drew closer, Shizuka couldn't swallow a sob of grief and a groan of horror. She slowed her pace, rocking to a stop, her small breasts heaving beneath her cotton shift. Grant grabbed her by the arm.
Come on!
She refused to move, and her three companions followed her gaze downward. All of them recoiled in revulsion. Two nearly fleshless faces grinned up at them from the soot-covered ground. Radiation and exposure had turned the faces into mummified travesties. They wore full suits of samurai armor and had apparently been caught in a microwave burst. It had literally cooked them inside their armor, like lobsters in their shells. Shizuka swallowed hard.
They came looking for me. I ordered them to stay with the boat, but they...
She bent and pulled a pair of bladed weapons from one of the corpses, a long katana sword and a shorter-bladed tanto. Kane relieved the other corpse of his pair of weapons, handed the katana to Bridget, and they started running again. When grass swished against their ankles, the four people realized they were out of the dead, defoliated zone.
When can we...
The rest of her question was lost in a distant thunderclap. They skidded to a halt, twisting their heads as a deafening, concussive blast cannonaded up from the complex of buildings behind them. A consecutive series of brutal, overlapping shockwaves rolled over the ground like invisible breakers, hurling up dust and ash and knocking the four of them flat. The ground heaved violently, and they heard a clash of rending rock and a distant shriek of rupturing metal. They saw the Operation Kronos complex seeming to shake itself to pieces. Cornices and basalt blocks toppled, crashing and colliding. All of them shared the same terror, that a chain reaction caused by the dilator's energies would touch off the atomic warhead, and a mile-high mushroom cloud would swallow not just Thunder Isle and Nuedo, but most of the Scific coast. A reverberating, extended thunderclap rolled as they saw the walls of buildings folding in on themselves and cascading down in a contained avalanche. In the dim light, veiled by swirling clouds of dust, the entire complex seemed to implode. Finally, the cataclysmic sounds began to fade, replaced by the crunch and grate of settling stone. Plains of dust and ash rose toward the sky. Kane squinted through the vapors and saw the dark edifice of the cube still towering in the distance, but its facade was riven through with cracks from which shimmers of light glowed. He spit some of the sour ash from his mouth.
What the hell happened?
Bridget looked over his shoulder.
I don't know. Maybe the dilator reached a point of critical mass and Sindri was able to contain it before it touched off the warhead. I don't know whether to be relieved or worried.
Grant pushed himself to his feet, pulling Shizuka with him.
For right now, let's be relieved. It's still at least a 40-minute walk to the beach. Sindri will do whatever he can to stop us from reaching it.
Shizuka threw him a startled look and gestured to the complex with a katana.
Surely you don't think he survived all of that?
He had as much time to escape as we did. Don't assume anything about that little man, particularly that he's dead.
Shizuka gazed at him steadily, then flicked her gaze to Brigid.
You respect him, don't you?
Her voice carried a note of incredulous challenge. Neither Kane nor Brigid responded to the query.
I don't.
They walked toward the jungle as the sun dropped lower in the sky. Twilight deepened over the island. This close to the dead zone, the fronds of the palm trees and leaves of shrubbery were stained and spotted with livid streaks of yellow. The sweet, fetid stench of decay was so thick it was almost sickening. Breathing through their mouths didn't help much, since the air tasted like a compost heap. Only Grant didn't appear discomfited by the odor. They strode among the close-set palm trunks, draped with loops and curves of flowering lianas hung down like nooses. Kane's point-man sense felt danger, and the feeling increased so it was almost tangible. On every hand, wherever they looked, there were growing plants, most of them ferns. The size ranged from tiny seedlings to monstrous growths the size of oak trees. Tangles of creeper vines carpeted the jungle floor. The atmosphere was like that within a greenhouse, impregnated with the overwhelming odor of vegetation and nearly impenetrable with water vapor. Grant's, Kane's, and Brigid's bodysuits kept them cool as the internal thermostats adjusted to the heat and humidity. Shizuka suffered in silence, her face and limbs sheened with perspiration, her hair hanging limp and damp. They stopped for a moment to rest and get their bearings. They couldn't hear the crash of breakers on the shoreline, but the gurgling of running water, either a river or a stream, came to them faintly. Another sound reached their ears. The four people froze in place, rooted to the spot. The foliage shook, the leaves rattling. Behind a tangled screen of greenery, they glimpsed a shaggy, lumbering beast.
What the hell?
Shizuka shushed Grant into silence. The creature suddenly reared up, standing at least 10 feet tall. The black, curving claws of the forepaws were at least 3 inches long, as were the yellow, saliva-slick canines revealed by black-rimmed lips. Its shaggy coat was a dark brown in color, tipped in silver. Shizuka looked in disbelief.
It's a bear! A bear on an island in the Pacific?
Brigid leaned next to her.
It's a cave bear. Extinct for at least 50,000 years. It must have been trawled here and released.
The bear sniffed the air, blinked its tiny eyes at them in utter disinterest, and dropped back down behind the wall of shrubs. The four people waited, not daring to relax, to move, speak, or even breathe hard. After a minute, Kane moved in quietly.
I think it moved on.
Grant and Kane instantly snapped their right arms up, flexing their wrist tendons against the holster's actuators to pop the sin-eaters into their waiting hands. Nothing happened. With a jolt of fear, Kane realized the microwave pulse might not have damaged him organically, but it had fried the tiny electric motor that activated the spring and cable mechanisms in the holsters. He came to an immediate and, on the face of it, insane decision. Hefting the Tonto sword, he lunged in front of his companions. The cave bear changed course, its claws tearing up clots of soft ground. Kane held steady. Brigid looked intensely at Kane.
What are you doing?
Run!
He sprang to one side just before the animal was on him and slashed a backhanded stroke at its hind legs that missed narrowly. Roaring in maddened fury, the bear dug in all four paws and skidded to a clumsy halt, loose leaves and loam cresting up in front of it like a wave. Kane bounded away from his companions, shouting again,
Run! I'm the fastest! I'll draw it away and meet you on the beach!
Kane, you goddamn show-off!
The rest of Grant's diatribe didn't reach Kane's ears as he sprinted into the jungle. Snarling slobberingly, the bear pounded after him. He began a flat-out run through the tangled green hell, ducking and dodging along paths that zigged and zagged like the trail left by a broken-backed snake. He hazarded only one quick glance backward. The bear was only 3 or so yards behind him, loping along with a clumsy, rocking gait, but not faltering at all. Foam flew from its open mouth, its red tongue lolling out between the fanged jaws. Kane did what he could to increase his speed, slashing through overhanging branches and vines. The skin between his shoulder blades itched in anticipation of a taloned paw tearing into his spine. He splashed through many shallow pools of stagnant water and jumped over a narrow channel that cut across his path. As he did so, he glimpsed the black water beneath him roil and bubble ominously, as if something large moved off the bottom toward the surface. However, the cave bear plowed through it without being molested. The pain of a stitch stabbed along Kane's left side. The muscles of his legs felt as if they were pressed between the jaws of a tightening vise, and his vision fogged. Nevertheless, he kept running, even though the blood thundered in his ears and his lungs noisily labored to suck in oxygen. He began to hope he had outdistanced his pursuer. With its greater weight, it couldn't really have the same stamina as he did. As he contemplated slowing, the ground disappeared beneath his feet. He caught only a glimpse of the surface of a wide ribbon of water. The drop to the water was 10 to 12 feet. He tried to align his body into a vertical position so he would enter the river in a dive. Instead, he half-belly-flopped against the surface, and it was all he could do to keep the air in his lungs. Water gushed up his nose and filled his sinus passages, trickling into his throat. Resisting the impulse to stroke for the surface, Kane allowed the weight of his sin-eater and short sword to keep him submerged and out of sight of the bear. The current tugged at him, and he kicked and pushed with it, since it was carrying him in the direction he wanted to go, toward the ocean. During his magistrate training, he used to practice holding his breath underwater, and rarely had he managed to exceed 4 minutes, even when he hyperventilated after the fashion of Polynesian pearl divers. Though he wasn't exerting himself and expending oxygen, his lungs were already aching with the strain. He opened his eyes and saw a school of small fish all around him, the silvery moonlight glinting from their delicate scales. He hoped they weren't carnivorous. The water buffeted him, making him lose all sense of direction and time. Kane stayed beneath the surface until the thundering of blood in his temples and the fire in his chest became intolerable. He kicked upward, a little surprised by how much effort it required. His head broke the surface, and he found the impulse to cough and gasp. The current carried him around a bend where the waterway narrowed. Tree limbs, like gnarled fingers, reached down toward the river from both banks. Blinking the water from his eyes, Kane tilted his head up and back, scanning the pale indigo sky. He saw nothing but the rising moon and a scattering of stars above the tree line. Kane knew better than to put the double-edged tanto blade between his teeth. The current was so strong it could slam him against an obstacle and cut half his head off. With one arm, he stroked for the right-hand bank, reaching up to grasp a low-hanging limb. Using the branch and roots as hand and footholds, Kane clambered his way up the muddy bank until he reached the top. He sat down to catch his breath. After a couple of minutes, he got up and walked inland, tanto in his hand, moving quietly through the brush. The sin-eater in its holster was a waterlogged encumbrance, and he contemplated removing the pistol from it, but he knew it would take time. The sound of a something, or someone, moving swiftly, if not noiselessly, through the foliage reached him, and he immediately sank to his knees beneath a leafy bush. He tried to penetrate the dark, overgrown tangle with his eyes, searching for any movement. Leaves crunched somewhere on the other side of the bush. Holding his breath, he waited for another sound. It came in the next few seconds, a hoarse, liquidy panting interspersed with grunts. Although he couldn't see it, Kane knew it was the cave bear, stalking along the riverbank, loath to give up its prey. He saw the shaggy beast lumber to within 10 feet of him, turning its huge head to and fro like a foxhound casting for a scent. It padded forward another few steps. Kane lay flat and could only hope his recent dousing had muted his scent. The cave bear moved on, the shadows between the tree ferns swallowing up its monstrous bulk. Kane waited 3 minutes to be sure, then slowly rose in a crouch. He was turning when the foliage behind him rustled violently. The bear surged over the ground in a juggernaut-like charge. Its lips were drawn back from its fangs in a contortion of rage, its eyes glistening. Kane threw himself backward, but the animal lashed with a paw the size of his head. Even as a thick-soled paw slammed into his left shoulder, his blade lashed out and he felt it sink briefly into yielding flesh. The impact of the blow jarred through the bones of his upper body, down to the small of his back. He didn't try to resist the kinetic force or keep his footing. He allowed himself to fall into the brush, reflexively slapping the ground to absorb the momentum and minimize the chances of having the wind knocked out of him. Shoulder throbbing, he rolled and got to his knees, knife still in his fist. The tapered tip gleamed with wet crimson. The cave bear thrashed on the ground, blood shooting from its severed neck arteries in a jet. It was in too much pain to even think of charging Kane again. It forced itself up on all fours and ran blindly until it rammed its head into the bole of a tree. It collapsed there, snarling until it choked on its blood and died. Slowly, Kane rose, his back throbbing with intense pain. His slash with the Tonto had been exceptionally lucky and wouldn't have been so effective if the blade were not so sharp. He inhaled a deep breath, wondering if he should feel pride in his accomplishment or pity for the bear, which had not asked to be snatched from its native environment and forced to survive in a strange new world. After a moment, Kane decided a little pride wouldn't hurt. Then he heard an ululating, croaking bellow from right behind him. A trumpet-like cry pierced the murk, followed by a deep-throated bawling. The dull reverberations of a heavy weight slamming repeatedly against the marshy earth made a racket that sent a shiver up Kane's spine, despite the heat and humidity. He dived into a hollow between intertwining ferns and lay there, fisting the Tonto and cursing himself for not using it to cut the Sin Eater free of its holster. Vegetation swished and crashed from somewhere behind him, and the ground shook incessantly. A dark shape loomed out of the gloom, propelled by a pair of massively muscled rear legs. The clawed forelegs were small in proportion to the rest of its body, but the curving, steel-hard talons tipping each of the three fingers were at least 6 inches long. They were drawn up to its chest almost in an attitude of praying. Grinning jaws bared rows of glistening yellow fangs. The saurian snout bore a pair of flared nostrils that seemed to dilate and twitch. The head, twice the size of that of a horse, turned this way and that upon an extended scaled neck. Huge cold eyes, like those of a serpent's 100 times magnified, stared unwinkingly from beneath a pair of scaled knobby protuberances. Two huge legs, almost as big around as some of the palm trees he'd seen, supported the massive barrel-shaped body. They were enormously overdeveloped. A long tail trailed from behind, disappearing into the undergrowth. It apparently used its thick tail to balance itself. Its damp hide bore a pebble-like pattern of dark brown scales. A revolting odor of rotted meat and the sour stench of reptiles clogged Kane's nostrils. So great was the monster's weight that its huge three-toed feet sank deep into the damp ground with each hopping step. Despite its size, the most frightening aspect of the creature was its fangs. They gleamed in the blunt, scale-armored maw that gaped wide to allow a long black tongue to dart to and fro. Kane guessed that, like a snake, its tongue was extremely sensitive, and it tasted the coppery tang of the bear's blood. Kane didn't know if the thing was a medium-sized tyrannosaur or an overly large dryosaurus, and at the moment, he didn't give a damn. He assumed it was the same monster that had bitten off the head of the hapless magistrate. The dinosaur bounded past him, then stopped abruptly, standing spraddle-legged over the dead cave bear. Its tongue continued to flicker in and out of its mouth as if it were tasting the air. The massive creature spun toward Kane's hiding place. Its tail lashed back and forth, shredding shrubbery and ferns. As it lowered its head, the flaring nostrils dilated. His blood running like ice water, Kane realized the creature had scented him, and it either perceived him as a threat to its meal of dead bear, or it preferred human meat to ursine. Kane sprang to his feet and ran as he had never run before, starting to dash to the left, then wheeling over to the right, lunging into a bed of ferns. The dinosaur clumsily turned and wallowed confusedly in the copse of vegetation for a moment. Kane guessed it was unaccustomed to having quarry evaded by the process of strategy. The monster appeared to be slow in getting itself organized. Lungs straining with the effort of breathing in the thick, humid air, Kane warred with the fear that threatened to engulf him. Complete panic gnawed at his nerves. He had an almost overwhelming desire to surrender sanity and plunge shrieking madly through the jungle. The ground trembled underfoot as the tyrannosaur changed course and pounded after him. Through the mist, Kane glimpsed a branch of a tree fern arching over the path he had taken. His steel spring legs propelled him upward in an adrenaline-fueled leap. The fingers of his left hand grasped, closed around it, and with a back-wrenching twist, he got himself atop it. He had only a second to wonder if the monster had seen the maneuver when it came blundering through the murky mist like an out-of-control locomotive. He realized the dinosaur wasn't as large as he had initially thought, maybe 25 feet long and between 12 and 15 feet tall. Still, it weighed in the vicinity of 3 tons, if not more. And it crashed into the trunk of the tree fern with a splintering impact. Kane slapped his hand around the branch, but because of the damp, smooth surface, he failed to cling, and he fell from his perch. The Tyrannosaur was directly beneath him, and he landed astride the monster's neck. More frightened than at any time in his life, feeling as if he were trapped in a hideous, ongoing nightmare, Kane clamped his legs about the creature's throat, wrapping his arms under its lower jaw and locking his ankles together. The Tyrannosaur was bewildered, astounded, and even a little outraged. It shook its head furiously from side to side in an attempt to dislodge its rider, but Kane clung tightly to keep from being hurled off. He knew if that happened, his life could be measured in seconds. A sweep of a clawed foot would disembowel him, or a snap of the jaws would decapitate him. The giant reptile attempted to rub him off by bending almost double and scraping its head against the turf, then against the trunks of the tree ferns. Even though the jungle growths had fairly smooth bark, his skin felt abraded despite the fabric of the bodysuit. Kane gritted his teeth against the pain and kept his legs locked at the hinges of the monster's jaws. The creature spun in a tight circle, twisting its head around to snap at him, performing a little spinning dervish dance like a dog chasing its tail. Its clawed feet tore up huge chunks of jungle floor. Then, in a wild panic, the scaled monster went charging through the jungle, hissing, bawling, and roaring. As the monster's fear grew, Kane's receded just enough so he could think tactically, if not necessarily rationally. He realized that though the gargantuan reptile's body was sheathed in powerful muscles, armored in a coat of thick scales, the flesh under his jaw was comparatively tender. It wasn't covered by the scales. Taking a deep breath, Kane clamped his thighs tighter around the monster's gullet and removed his right hand from where it had gripped his left wrist. He drove the 18-inch steel blade of the Tonto to half its length into the dinosaur's throat, as close to the jaw hinge as he could manage. Kane tightened his legs around the monster's neck while he stabbed again and again with his long blade. Hot, thick blood spilled over his hand and wrist, soaking his sleeve halfway to the elbow. The Tyrannosaur crashed through the jungle, battering its head blindly against trees. Kane was shaken, struck, and leaf-whipped, but he continued thrusting with a razor-keen sword. He caught a glimpse of a long branch drooping in the Tyrannosaur's path as the dinosaur bounded beneath it. The blunt head cleared it by less than a foot. Kane released his Tonto and relaxed his scissors lock around the reptile's neck. In the same instant, he threw his arms up and caught hold of the limb. The limb sagged beneath his weight, but the dinosaur continued its thundering charge, its sluggish brain not immediately registering the fact that the presence of the prey, turned tormentor, was gone. By the time it did, Kane had dropped to the jungle floor, retrieved his knife, and glided into the undergrowth. He knelt down, breathing heavily, his heart pumping hard. He tried to repress his trembling. He bit his lips and clutched the handle of the Tonto. After a few minutes, when the crash and thud of the Tyrannosaur's mad flight had receded in the distance, he slowly got to his feet. If Brigid, Grant, and Shizuka had spent a more uncomfortable hour in their lives, they couldn't easily recall it. Blood-curdling screams echoed from one end of the island to the other. Finding a place in the jungle to hole up and rest was completely out of the question. The three people waited in expectation of sudden death at any moment. A heavy rain began to fall, a tropical downpour that lasted only a few minutes, but it was sufficient to raise the humidity level and create clouds of fog. Water dripped from the low branches. At one point, they came across a four-legged lizard sitting in the middle of their path, eating at the carcass of some small dead creature. It hissed at them, and they gave it a wide berth. None of the three spoke much. Brigid's and Grant's thoughts were with Kane and what he might be going through. They came out of the wall of palm trees and labyrinth of underbrush onto a rocky beach. They also saw, moored to one of the tree trunks, a 12-foot-long landing boat from New Edo. Grant quickly inspected it, making sure it still had its oars. Its keel looked intact. Shizuka went to his side.
How long do we wait for Kane?
Brigid answered for him.
For as long as it takes.
Shizuka glanced at her a bit reproachfully.
I was not implying otherwise. I was about to suggest we wait until daybreak. If he's not back by then, we make our way to New Edo and return with a much larger and better armed party.
Grant knuckled his chin thoughtfully. Then he stiffened, eyes narrowed as they fixed on the jungle perimeter. Brigid and Shizuka followed his intense stare.
What? What did you see?
I'm not sure. I thought I saw something moving.
Grant stepped slowly forward, feet crunching on the gravel. He stopped and listened. He didn't hear a sound, and he searched the dark spaces between the trees with his eyes and saw nothing. Then Sherrinford Oakshott stepped out of the shadows. His baby mouth glistened with saliva. He stood quite still and looked impassively at Grant. His huge shoulders hunched, and he raised an arm. He gripped a double-bladed hatchet in his enormous, bald fist.
Shit.
Shizuka tossed him the katana she had retrieved. Grant snatched it out of the air and lunged forward, driving the curved point of the blade at Oakshot's chest. The giant slapped the blade contemptuously aside. Oakshott, in a surprisingly swift movement, swept a leg into Grant's ankles. Taken completely off guard, Grant couldn't jump away. He was bowled over and cracked the back of his head sharply on the rocky shoreline. Multicolored pinwheels spun behind his eyes, and he clung to consciousness, groping for the katana. Abandoning the sword, he managed to get to his feet just as Oakshott closed with him, trying to bury the blade of his hand axe in the crown of Grant's head. The former mag hit him with all the strength he could muster, the heel of one hand under the giant's chin. It was like punching a granite statue. Oakshott swiped overhand blows with the hatchet at Grant's head, trying to split his skull. He deflected two of the blows, feinted with his right fist, and smashed his left into Oakshott's face. Pain seared up Grant's knuckles into his wrist as bone crunched beneath his fist. He sidled away. Oakshott remained standing, blinking a bit in mild bemusement, ignoring the blood trickling from the 2-inch cut on his cheek. He dropped the hatchet at his feet as if he had forgotten it. Oakshott didn't move for a long time. Grant prayed he was suffering from a delayed reaction to his blow and would simply drop over unconscious. It didn't happen. His head twitched from side to side, his little eyes searching for his weapon. Grant jumped for the fallen hatchet, but the giant moved to cut him off. He dodged aside and eluded the great grasping arms. As Oakshott came after him, Grant rammed the crown of his head into the man's face. Oakshott stumbled and tottered, but kept his feet. He blew scarlet bubbles from his split lips. He grinned, exposing red-filmed teeth.
You behave, Sarah.
Where's your keeper?
Grant let a taut smile play lazily on his face.
He send you out here? Or did you take the initiative?
Oakshott acted as if he hadn't heard. He bent and picked up the axe and spun it skillfully around by the handle, the double-bladed head dancing like a cobra preparing to strike. His familiarity with the weapon was apparent. Grant watched his opponent as they circled each other on the beach. He darted forward, feinting to the left. As Oakshott swung the hatchet, Grant dived under the edged steel, plucked up the sword, and lashed out with one smooth motion. The blade razored along his stomach, slicing through his coat and shirt and opening a long, shallow cut. Oakshott gazed down at the wound with dispassionate eyes. Grant closed with him, not bothering with the feint, trying for contact with the katana. Oakshott blocked with his hatchet, and steel rang on steel. He was strong enough to stop Grant's knife, then brought the axe down in a sideways slash. Once again surprised by the giant's speed, Grant narrowly avoided the blow. The hand axe whistled through the air, missing Grant's shoulder by a fractional margin. The huge man came at him at once, exploding into motion. Giving ground before the charge, Grant kept the katana flashing, meeting a half dozen attacks in a row, sparks skidding in all directions as he met a dozen more. He listened to Oakshott's breathing, hoping, with all the weight he carried, he would get winded quickly. He wasn't sure if it made any difference. A man who could cough up a 9mm hollow point slug in his lungs and recover from hydrostatic shock inside a couple of minutes wasn't likely to tire easily. Grant launched a front stab kick that caught Oakshott in the chest. Oakshott staggered backward, then set his feet and charged again, holding the axe high. Staying loose, bouncing on the balls of his feet, Grant danced with death. Glittering steel edges slashed by his face, missing by scant millimeters, turned or parried by Grant's weapon or his forearms. Perspiration beaded his forehead. Oakshott brought the hatchet down in a vicious overhand blow, aiming at Grant's upturned face. Grant sidestepped, using all of his mag skills and experience to avoid the giant's rush. Grant leaned in, closing his fist around the axe's haft. He slipped his forearm in front of Oakshott's wrist, blocking the blow with bone-jarring contact, hoping to knock the weapon free. But Oakshott's grip held. Concentrating on his moves, keeping the weapon locked down, Grant brought a knee up and slammed Oakshott in the groin. The kick knocked Oakshott backward, but he managed to lift the hand axe. Grant dived in again, driving his opponent back with sword slashes and thrusts. Oakshott managed to avoid them. Grant lashed out again, turning the huge man's hatchet away, but was not able to beat through Oakshott's defenses. He landed 3 kicks against the bigger man's side and stomach, But before he could disengage, Oakshot's axe sliced a thin, shallow furrow along his right temple. Grant felt the flow of blood running down his neck. Oakshot came for him, a juggernaut of flesh and blood and glittering steel. Grant's sword moved mechanically, blocking the attacks, feeling the man's incredible strength, listening to the quick flicking scrapes of steel. Oakshot lunged at him, but Grant sidestepped easily. He rammed the long katana blade through Oakshot's ribs, hoping to drive it home into the man's heart. Oakshot turned enough to make him miss his heart, and the blade was locked in the clutch of ribs. Oakshot swung the hatchet in a backhand blow. Ducking, Grant caught himself on his left hand in a crouch, then shot his right foot out at his opponent's knee. He aimed the kick from the side, with Oakshot totally exposed and vulnerable. Oakshot grunted, but didn't go down. Droplets of blood sprayed from his lips, and Grant knew the knife might have missed the man's heart, but it was buried deep in a lung. An ordinary man would have drowned in his own blood as his lungs filled. Oakshot grasped the handle of the long sword and drew it from his body, the length of steel covered with blood. He groaned between clenched teeth as he did so. He glanced at it, as if surprised to find it in his hand, and dropped it to the beach. Grant bounded to recover it. Oakshot pistoned out his arm, and his right hand grasped Grant around the neck. Gagging, Grant pried at the fingers, crushing flesh, tendon, and cartilage into bone. Oakshot lifted him from the ground and slammed him down, putting his weight on Grant's throat to hold him in place. He lifted the hatchet for a skull-splitting blow. He drew up his knees in a protective gesture and shot both heels upward with a pistoning force into the giant's crotch. Lifted in the air, Oakshot sailed backward. He hit the ground hard on the back of his head and neck, the axe blade chiming against the rocks. Grant staggered to his feet, vision clouded, breath clogging in his throat. Oakshot rose as well, hatchet in hand. Grant spoke without looking behind him.
Bridget, Shizuka, push off in the boat. If I can...
The stamp of heavy feet propelling a monstrous body filled Grant's ears. Propelled by gargantuan legs, a creature lunged out of the jungle. Before Grant, Bridget, and Shizuka could move, the monster landed on the beach right behind Oakshot. He turned, chopping at it with a hatchet. The mountainous mass of muscle that made up most of the bulk of the dinosaur did not even flinch as the blade rebounded from its hide. Even in the feeble light, Grant saw blood gleaming darkly on its throat. The creature was wounded, in a frenzy of pain, and attacking anything that caught its eye. The creature lowered its head, its great jaws open, then closed with a loud snap. Caught by the head and shoulders, Oakshot was lifted high in the air. His legs kicked in a futile spasm. The monster bounded away, its huge fangs shearing through flesh, crunching through bones. Grant saw the lower half of Oakshot's body fall to the ground. Then the dinosaur was gone. Grant, Shizuka, and Bridget stood rooted to the spot, staring in wide-eyed shock. Bridget was the first to speak.
Entropic reversal isn't going to help him now.
No shit.
Kane came limping out of the jungle. Bridget ran to him, but he waved her away.
I'm all right. I'm all bloody, but it's not mine. It's that dinosaur's. He's been after me for the last half hour. I'm glad somebody else caught his attention.
I'm just glad it was that madman.
Shizuka went to Grant's side. They looked thoughtfully at each other in silent surmise. Kane felt suddenly awkward.
We can always go back to the installation and see if the gateway unit survived.
Grant didn't even look at him.
I've got a better idea. Let's go back to New Edo, at least for a few days. Then we can decide how to get back to Cerberus, or even if we really want to.
He cupped the side of Shizuka's face, and she embraced him. They kissed passionately. Bridget and Kane stepped away toward the edge of the jungle. She gazed into it without really seeing it. Kane guessed she was looking beyond the vegetation to the distant Operation Kronos complex, or what was left of it.
I think we should stay in New Edo for a while. We should check out the Kronos base. There are too many secrets there just to turn our backs on.
What kind of secrets?
The secrets of creation. The secrets of the beginning of life on Earth.
She glanced over at Kane questioningly.
You understand me, right?
Kane looked down at the deep, three-toed imprints of the dinosaur's feet in the sand.
Not in a million years, Baptiste.
Thank you.
Outlander's Tomb of Time is a Graphic Audio production. Outlanders and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2001, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2005, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, and Kate Torrey. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Terrence Aselford and Chris Rowan. The Outlanders theme was composed by Norman Vanderslice. If you enjoyed Outlanders, be sure to look for James Axler's Deathlands, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
The following preview is of a Graphic Audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Deathlands 53, Savage Armada.
No, they know we mean business. Okay, swabs, prime your blasters and grab a blade. You there, Master Gunner, give me 6 cannons with solid shot on my command. No more and no sooner. Aim to hit amidships. Only got 10 shots. Gotta make everyone count. Get going.
On my way.
JB tossed Mildred the shotgun. She made the catch, and he took off at a run.
Doc, Dean, with me.
Doc and Dean followed close behind the armorer. Grimly, Mildred slid a fresh cartridge from the loops on the shoulder strap and fed it into the belly of the S&W M4000. Not buckshot, but the stainless steel flechette slivers. Just let the pirates get close, and they'd think they stepped into a meat grinder.
Ready, on the deck! Aim! Mind the pan flash! Fire!
A dozen sailors discharged their flintlock muskets. Puffs of smoke on the enemy ship showed where the 75 caliber mini-balls impacted, but not a pirate fell. In response, a flight of arrows from the Delta Blue arched into the sky, then plummeted to hit all over the Constellation, mostly only punching holes in the taut sails. Ryan shot again. A lantern shattered, starting a small fire. The archers rushed to extinguish the blaze.
Good shot!
Ryan jacked a fresh round into his weapon. The pirate cannons bellowed flame and smoke, and another volley of cannonballs whistled over the deck, but much lower. Caught loading her weapon, the busty redhead gave half a scream as she was hit directly in the stomach. Blood vomited from her mouth, and both arms and legs broke off from the brutal collision. The torso went sliding across the deck, leaving a crimson wake, and went over the side of the ship.
Oh, Susie.
Estimating the range at 150 yards, Ryan started leveling rounds at the pirates. The man in the crow's nest clutched his face and fell, spiraling to the deck. The acne-scarred man flinched as a spoke on the wheel exploded into splinters, but he never let go and continued doggedly for the Constellation. Ryan aced 3 more men on the open deck, but it seemed to make no difference. Another pirate was already climbing into the crow's nest, shouting orders to the crew below. The rest of the companions stood with blasters ready, waiting for the other ship to get closer so they could shoot.
Ace them!
The others cut loose, the barrage of rounds startling the pirates and chilling several.
We need a bastard bazooka!
Ryan jacked out the spent magazine and shoved it into a pocket. Searching his belt, he found another rotary clip of 5 rounds and slid it into the open breech of the hot weapon.
Satchel charge!
Shotgun slung over a shoulder, Mildred thumbed fresh rounds into her ZKR-38 target pistol.
Ready! Fire!
The crew shot their muskets once more. As the crew of the Constellation reloaded, Only two arches on the Delta Blue unleashed arrows, then the pirates fired their long blasters. Rounds hummed by and a rope parted, but nobody was hit. However, the three-masted ship was much closer and gaining every minute.
What's that?
We're ready, Captain.
Then fire!
The Constellation shook from the volley of her cannons, dark smoke stretching across the waters. On the pirate ship, a water barrel exploded. Several pilots reeled, covered with splinters, and a large section of the front gunwale was torn away. A pirate fell, missing a leg, and was dragged to safety by his crewmates. But the broadside had done little damage.
Too high! Use chain this time!
Chain?
Doc swabbed out a hot cannon to quench any lingering sparks inside. He withdrew the wet bundle of rags and stroked in the dry rags to remove any excess moisture.
You'll see, Doc. Load these two. We've got to conserve.
When Doc and Dean had done their jobs and retreated to a safe distance, JB used a piece of burning rope on the end of a pole to touch off the fuses. The three cannons roared in a neat line, the black smoke of the discharge blocking their view for a few moments. As it cleared away, the companions saw a dozen ropes dangling loose, sliced completely through by the whirling length of heavy chain spinning across the ship. A lot of men on deck were missing, and the aft mast slowly cracked and toppled over into the sea, taking five men caught in the rigging along with it into a watery grave. The pirate ship was crippled, but still moving closer.
Again!
A huge tear appeared in the forward sail, and a gaping hole was punched in the side of the Delta Blue, a good 10 feet above the waterline.
By the three Kennedys, we missed! Just a tad lower and she'd be sinking like a rock.
Once more should do it.
With fucking what? That was it for black powder. There's nothing left in the barrels. Now we go up on deck and dig in with the rest.
I have 2 pounds of black powder. Any good?
Useless. Wouldn't get a 12-pound ball halfway.
Oh, to hell with it.
Dean went to the nearest open hatch. Pulling out his Browning semi-automatic blaster, he aimed at the pirates.
Dean, no!
Why not? Might get one of them.
Firing from a cannon port would mean we are out of powder, and that means we are defenseless. But are we really defenseless?
What's a plan?
C4, my good man. Do we have any left?
Dark Knight. We do.
JB rummaged in the munitions bag hanging from his shoulder. The armorer extracted a grayish rectangle of what looked like oily clay.
Hot damn! A full block! That might be enough.
Start cutting. We'll do the rest.
As JB got busy with a knife, Dean's face suddenly brightened in understanding, and the boy joined the silver-haired man at a portal, banging away steadily with his Browning. The row of cannons on the Delta Blue thundered again, and the Constellation trembled as something slammed into her sides.
Grapeshot! Got holes in us from stem to stern.
Above the water level?
Aye, sir.
Then fuck it. Keep firing.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.